James Husted.
Do I have to turn this on or anything?
It's on.
Oh, it's on, okay.
Is there audio on your...
No, there isn't, so you can turn off. And I have to run it from here because my my remote control works through a network that I'm not connected to. I'm going to be basically doing an overview sort of thing. This particular slideshow that I have is much longer than what I'm going to talk about. So I may jump through some things really quickly. If you have any questions about anything, don't hesitate to yell them out, okay? Because I'm basically don't mind. So we'll start off with the simple stuff, the basics. We say modular synthesis. This is what modular means, you know, related to or based to a module or modulus. I love that description. It talks about itself. constructed with standardized units or dimensions for flexibility in a variety of use, as in modular furniture. That's the one that fits the most appropriately. And you can see the phrase wasn't used until 1936. So that's modular. And synthesis is from the Greek. And again, it's the one we're looking at is the composition or combination of parts or elements as to form a whole, or the different conceptions. So that's what we're dealing with in a modular synthesizer. Unlike your standard symbol like a Mini Moog or an ARP Odyssey or one of those are preset up for a particular audio path and a particular usage. And there's nothing wrong with that. They're quite flexible. A lot have internal routings that allow you to break away from the standard voice architecture. But with a modular synthesizer, they won't make a sound at all until you patch it up. So as you, as a musician in the modular world, you take on all three aspects of musicality. You are the musician who plays the instrument, because you're probably not going to let someone else play it. You know, you're going to do it yourself. You're also the composer of the stuff, the music for it, because there's no syntax like musical instrument writing to write for these things. There's no standardized thing that says, you know, this is a sweep up or whatever, you know. It's a lot of the abstract stuff. But the most important one is the third one. You are the instrument maker. Not only do you play the stuff and compose for the stuff, but you have to design the instrument that you're going to be playing and composing on, because it does not just come out playing, you know, like that. This is a basic history of a timeline of the earliest synthesizers, or what can be called a synthesizer. And you can see back in 1837, Mr. C.G. Page was the first to produce an electronically generated sound. Okay, he invented a battery called the Volta. And part of his experimenting with the battery was he was using coils and a few other things. And it caused a sympathetic vibration onto a piece of metal tine, and it made a note, it made a tone. And he basically made a machine then that did that. It wasn't anything that you'd call a musical instrument, though. I mean, you couldn't play tones, tonalities, and do lines and stuff on it. But it was the first electronically generated sound. You can see that 1837, that's pretty good. In 1885, I'm not even going to try and say it. The first musical instrument designed to produce electronically generated sounds. This was designed as a musical instrument. It had a keyboard. Basically, it was like playing a punch of doorbells, door ringers. You know, the mechanical thing would just like be a ring, 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 ring. You know, I'm sure it sounded very, very nice. the teleharmonium was the next one. It was an electromechanical instrument. It's basically like a very large Hammond organ. It was a tone wheel generated. It was huge. It was not something you'd move around. I have some pictures I'll show later that will show that one. And then there's a mixture charonium, which was using subharmonic synthesis, using low-frequency oscillators, or not oscillators, but tone generators, I should say. Most of these were mechanical at this point. Then Homer Dudley, who first made the vocoder, and these were not technically musical instruments, but have since been used as musical devices. And this was mainly to improve the sound going over telephony. You know, there's a very bandwidth constraint on telephone lines, and you know, the technology was really bad. So he made this idea of, oh, well, we'll construct these series of filters at the front end that will make control voltage sort of things that would at the other end enhance the sound. And it never really got anywhere used in telephony. So, but Hugh LaCrane, he made the electronic sackbut, which was the first voltage controlled synthesizer. A sackbut is a Renaissance trombone, basically. So this instrument was a keyboard instrument that the most incredible part about it was that you could play the instrument, and by moving the keys physically left and right, you could add vibratos effects. By moving the keys forward and backwards, you got timbral changes. And by pressing down harder on them, you got volume changes. So it was a true polyphonic controlled CV instrument. It's very, very cool. And then Dr. Raymond Scott had the wall of sound, which was, he was the one who came up with the first sequencing workstation and the first electronic sequencer. And we're talking, I'll have another picture in the next slide, basically a giant wall of test type equipment that was used to make music. And then we go on beyond that, and you can see there's the computer, the CSIR Mark II, Mark I, which was the RCA computer that was used to make a lot of sounds. It was more of an experimental type of thing. And then Louis and B.B. Baron, who produced the soundtrack for the motion picture for Forbidden Planet. They did that soundtrack using manually controlled oscillators and tape techniques. And in fact, an interesting side on theirs was that this music unions were so upset with them making the soundtrack. At first, they were just going to do some incidental sounds in the thing. And then the guys, the producers of the movie said, oh, that, this sounds great. Do the whole thing. So they did the whole soundtrack. They could not put musician as their title or soundtrack, musical soundtrack, as their title in the movie because the music unions were so upset about it that they were instead called electronic tonalities. Was how they were billed on the movie, and because of that, they weren't allowed to get a Oscar. So
I ran across a thing the other day that was written by John Philip Sousa in 1906, complaining vehemently about mechanical reproduction of music and how it's going to kill the music industry, and no one's ever going to learn how to play instruments again.
Yeah.
So the more things change.
So you can see the jumps in times were up into the 50s, so, and then there's the first digital synthesizers, and then Don Buchla in 63 with the Series 100 100 level Buchla synthesizers, and then Robert Moog, who came out in 67 with the first, the Model 1 and 2 and 3. And here are pictures of those instruments, and you can just see the teleharmonium was a giant room full of gear. And on the, it was called that because it was all connected. The machine that actually made the sound was in a completely different room. You know, another floor. And then these guys sat at this keyboard thing that was, you can see it was like a telephone terminal. Thousands of wires went back into the other side. And I have another picture that I didn't put on here, but right behind those two guys sitting on the keyboard is this giant horn that goes back to the driver, and they're like, oh, yeah. And you know, the sackbut, you can see, it's actually still have the working prototype is in a museum on the East Coast, I believe. And you can see it was a totally mechanical thing. The left hand was the hand that did all the special magic, that could do the tonalities and all that sort of stuff. And the right hand did some too, but it was mainly a controller hand, and it had like a lever that his thumb would push, and you know, this stuff like that. It was pretty cool. And the wall of sound, as you can see, was mainly just like walls of tech equipment, oscillators and filters and stuff. And you can barely see the sequencer. This is the sequencer. And it's a mechanical device. It's a rotating wheel with things that you slotted into the wheel that clicked relays. And apparently, if you walked on the other side of that wall, you were deafened by the sound of relays clicking back and forth that was doing all the control stuff. It was all done with relays and very mechanical stuff. It was just out of control. This is when the 60s and 70s started up, these were the big players of that time. And there. The EMU was on the West Coast. EMS was the large English makers, the first ones with a portable synthesizer. They were the first ones to make what you would call a semi-modular today, which is the VCS-3 was all in one unit, and it had the Presto, the patch bay was done with little pins. It was meant to be a completely internal unit. It had two outputs to go out to outside worlds, but it was mainly meant to be a standalone by itself. And it was the first one in that era that was like that, instead of these larger ones, which were made of modules that you plugged in, you know, and did that sort of stuff. The Moog, of course, was an East Coast machine. The ARP was an East Coast machine. The ARP, that was the very first synthesizer I learned to play on, was an ARP 2500, which is the one in the lower left corner there. Surge and Buchla, which were more experimental, and you can see there was a slight, nowadays it's called the East Coast, West Coast schism. It was basically the philosophies involved in making the synthesizers. The East Coast synthesizers, like the ARP and the Moog, had keyboards, and they were meant to be played, meant to do music stuff primarily. Whereas the West Coast, like the Surge, the Buchla, those were abstract generating machines. They didn't really have true keyboards. They had keyboard-like instruments on them that you could, you know, pads you press, and you could dial a dial what note you wanted that pad to represent and stuff. But they were not meant to be played like an instrument like that. They were meant to generate tonalities. And so you've got a lot of players like Morton Subotnick and those who would do these really, really abstract stuff that was just intense stuff. And it was all done on Buchlas and Surge. Some breaks in the thing. EMU was a West Coast company, but I heard at dinner tonight, actually, from a gent who worked with EMU that they really didn't want to put a keyboard on there.
He teaches here?
What's his name?
Dave Bristow,
yeah. He said that that they were very reluctant to put an actual keyboard on the machine, that it was Dave Rawson, I think, who pressured to do it. And in fact, it's really good that they did, because the digital scanning keyboard that they invented became like a phenomenal thing. It became it was in an Oberheim synthesizer. It was like a giant step in synthesizer keyboards, and that you could play, two notes. My God, you know, like three notes. What's with this? You know, so it was pretty cool. And EMS was an English company, so they were kind of in their own little world. And in a lot of ways, they were in their own little world. Their voltages were different and other stuff. I'll talk about that a little bit later. This is the landscape that's happening now as far as the different sizes of synthesizers. You heard in the movie they were talking about, those 5U guys and the Eurorack guys. Well, this is the format sizes that we have now. This is a unique one that George Mattson has. It's a Mattson Mini synthesizer format. He's the only one that makes stuff. Scott, that's right. He's the only one that makes make stuff in this size?
Yep. Okay. His brother.
Yeah, that's George's brother. The next one in is the Eurorack size, which is a 3U. This is a Eurorack. 3U, a U is a standard 1.75 inches that's used in the electronics industry. Most of your rack effects and stuff like go in these racks here are like 1U or 2U or 3U or so. That's that size. Very same size, but for some unmistakable, weird way, the holes are in a different location on what is called a frack rack. And there are some people who make conversion units that you can mix and match a frack rack and a Euro rack together in the same cabinet. Then we go up to the 5U stuff. This is a mod cam, I believe, and this is a Buchla. And then it jumps up into even a larger size stuff. This is Synthesis Technologies, and then it goes up in even to these weirder ones that are all, ones at that end are the unique ones. The ones at this end are more, you have more manufacturers making for them. So what are the standards? So we have different manufacturers that are working in this space. So are there standards? The first one is the pitch control voltage. Almost everybody uses 1 volt per octave. This, at the beginning, back when the original synthesizers happened, there's a lot of weirdo stuff. There's the Asian companies, a lot of them were using 1 volt per hertz instead of, they called that a hertz per octave. I think it was different terms for it, but basically it was, instead of a logarithmic thing, it was a linear. It was cheaper to make because of that. And so you tried to plug something like a Roland synth into an Emu or something like that, and they would not track together. The other one are gate signals. When you press a button or you use something on these machines, you produce a voltage that goes from low to high, and this tells some instrument to turn on. And this can be a manual control. It could be done from like a sequencer like this. It's spitting out one for every time it jumps to a new step, you know, that sort of stuff. This is different on different synthesizers, but typically the new ones now will run from 5 volts to 15 volts. Most synthesizers are built to recognize anything in that range. Like most of the Dofer stuff here is like 8 volts. But in the beginning, and still now, the Moog stuff used a switch to ground, a complete opposite, and you had to make a converter, you know, to make Moog stuff work with anybody else's. So over the attrition over the ages has kind of zoomed down to this sort of thing here. Other things are the waveforms, and this can be all over the map. Some synthesizers use waveforms that are all unipolar. They start at 0 volts and go to 10 volts. A lot of them do from negative 5 to positive 5. Most synthesizers won't care. I mean, if you plug something that goes beyond that range, it will either ignore it or it will try to do something with it and fail. You know, but you will probably not hurt the synthesizer by doing that, because there are many users who add stuff with multiples. You get a panel called a multiple, which is basically 4 jacks or 8 jacks in a row that are just interconnected, so you can fan out Y-cord your patch cords. So people tend to use those incorrectly by taking 3 or 4 sources and plugging them into there. And so you end up with like these 20-volt swings and stuff like that. And basically most of the waveforms, the things downstream will just stop. You know, they'll just, at the end of whatever the power supply voltage in the unit is, that's what it'll peak out. You know, so these machines run on plus or minus 12 volts. That's how they're powered. So if you hit it with anything over 12 volts and it's just going to ignore it. It's just not going to be able to deal with it. And like I said, all systems should be designed to handle any of this stuff without dying. And most of them are. There are some machines, Dofer did make some things that if you put a negative voltage into the jack, it would blow it up. And so they ended up changing those things after they had to deal with a lot of people dying. So what are the differences between these systems? Because we're talking about lots of different manufacturers, lots of different places that these are being manufactured. The primary difference was the size that I showed you. You know, you can buy cases for all these different stuff. And in the olden days, in those first synthesizers I showed, the major modulars, you bought an EMU box to put your modules in there. You couldn't plug anybody else's module in that box because it physically was one size. And so that kind of stuck you into buying EMU. You know, if you bought a Surge, you couldn't plug any other modules in there. Surge actually made these giant panels, which had 1-inch by 1-inch grid of holes, and all their modules were manually put into these panels by your order. You know, you ordered, oh, I want, you know, this envelope generator, this random noise generator, whatever, and they would build it for you. And they had these stickers that they stuck, the front panel graphics were done with a vinyl sticker. And so, you know, boom, there you go. But you couldn't, like, plug somebody else's synthesizer module into that case. You know, you were stuck with Surge stuff. So you'd either have to buy another case or you'd have to, you know, go without. And the cases were typically the most expensive things. Like, in fact, these Dofer cases, they started off, these were like $500 for just the box and the power supply that things went into. There's a lot of competition now in that space, so there's a lot of people making those. Again, the power supplies were the differences there too. The Dofer stuff and most of this Eurorack is plus or minus 12 volts. The 5U stuff is plus or minus 15 volts. And some people will argue, okay, more voltage means more signal-to-noise ratio, but when you're talking about the difference between 12 volts and 15 volts, you're not really talking about a lot, so you're not really going to gain much. But it is like these guys who on the bulletin boards are like, 15 volts, man! They're like totally like into it. And this is the biggest difference, is the patch cord religious war. These Eurorack uses 1/8-inch or 3.5 millimeter jacks. The big format stuff use 1/4-inch jacks. Somebody like Buchla actually uses banana connections for all the control voltage stuff, but it uses eighth inch stuff for the audio. Surge uses banana all the way across for both audio and for control voltages. So it becomes another big, you know, religious war. Like I say, you go onto the sites and there's guys who will just who buy these Euro things, rip out all the jacks and put in bananas, you know, where they can. And they'll say, oh yeah, but you can stack them, you know, they're more robust and all this stuff. Well, one of the guys on the video, Gurr Mielsen, he's the guy behind Tip Top Audio, he invented a stackable eighth inch. I don't have any because I don't actually like them. But basically, it has a jack on the side, so you can stack multiple eighth-inch jacks. And of course, to me, that stresses the jacks and does a bunch of stuff. But that's a big, big war, you know, there between. And you can buy modules that will do the conversions for you. You know, they're just a panel. There's one called a Format Jumbler, which has quarter-inch banana and eighth-inch, and they're just interconnected. They're just rows of jacks that are interconnected. You just plug one in, plug out what you want. Yeah.
Do you ever find a stereo jack anywhere except on maybe the output?
You probably won't even find it on the output. The eighth inch stereo, what the problem is that a lot of these jacks are different manufacturers use different, the jack that connects to the ground part, some use the actual shield, but you can see these are plastic jacks. So you can find some manufacturers where the ground actually hits where the ring would be on a stereo plug. And so if you plug a stereo jack into one module into another manufacturer, you can see there's like seven or eight different manufacturers shown in the system. You may run across a situation where that will not connect. And if it's in a different cabinet, then you have problems. Usually in the same cabinet, the ground's getting there some other way, so there's no problems. But typically, the mono plugs are what you're looking at here. And like I said, there's a dot cables for a cross thing. This is a current list of some of the manufacturers. Like I said, when I started getting into Euro, there was maybe a dozen manufacturers or so, and now there's hundreds. There's literally hundreds of companies that just make one or two modules. That's all they make now. They sell online almost exclusively. There's hardly any stores you can walk into and actually see the stuff because it'd be a nightmare for a store guy. You have to teach somebody how to actually run this stuff. And also when your guy goes in and he goes, oh yeah, I want to buy this system. You know, well, that system is eight different manufacturers and, you know, it's going to cost you this much money and blah, blah, blah. And there's enough hurdles getting into the stuff to begin with. But in any case, online is the way to go. There's a couple of dealers online, like Analog Haven is a good place that carries. You can go down their list of manufacturers. And like I said, it's like a page of stuff.
But that's not to say that, like, Rich, if he gets a modular
section
in his, that's only right now we're having.
Yeah, there's a store in Portland, and Rich is thinking about doing that here in Seattle. It's a big investment for a store to do this because, you have to buy stock and you have to worry about people breaking and walking off with patch cords and that sort of stuff.
But just like anything else, I think the way this modular is coming up,
yeah,
point it's got to be that the guy on the street is going to walk in. So yeah.
That's why these synth fests are so important because people can come in and actually touch the stuff. And one of the modules we make is this pressure-sensitive module that you press on the pad, and the harder you press, the more control voltage comes out. Well, that's really hard to sell without someone touching it. You know, I mean, they don't really understand the feel of it and its sensitivity until they actually lay their fingers on it. And then they go, oh, wow, that's so much better than the other techs I've dealt with. So,
you ever see the stuff sold on consignment at one of the music stores, maybe?
There are a very large growing used market. In fact, I have bought none of this stuff new. Okay, and so this is completely used, and the resale market, the resale value on most of the modules is fairly high. You can get 30 or 40% off of the cost of the unit.
They're either used or you made them yourself.
I either made them myself or they're used or I traded other manufacturers. Like I would never have been able to afford the sequencer, but thankfully I found that Scott wanted a few things I had, so. Okay, I'm just gonna kind of crank these up all the way. Go backwards. These are the typical module types. In the family of a synthesizer, you may look at these and they all look completely different, but they usually either do one or more of these functions. You have modules that create sound, modules that modify sound, modules that create control signals to run those other modules, and modules that modify control signals. Those are your basic group of modules. Everything will fit in here. Some will, like I said, will do more than one thing at a time. It's often that you can find a audio modifier of people that will also modify control voltages. Like a mixer is a perfect example. You can plug CVs into a lot of these mixers and also audio and be able to mix them together just as equally. That's why, especially in a module arrangement like this, where the jack is the same for both control voltages and for audio. It doesn't really matter what you plug in. And you're not going to damage stuff unless you're like really doing some really stupid stuff that are hard to do. You're most likely not going to damage anything by just plugging around. You may get results that don't create a sound that you like or anything like that, are not useful, but those are the happy accidents. Modifiers, audio modifiers are like filters, ring modulators, voltage controlled amplifiers, things that take the raw sound of the oscillators, which create the sound, and filter them or modify them. Voltage control voltage generators are like the sequencer, which as it walks through the steps, each step has got a row of knobs, and you can dial the control voltage for that step. And so as it walks through, it will place, you know, melodies or whatever you have on, or doesn't need to control melodies. It could be doing also tonality changes. We also make a programmer unit that is a manual version. Well, this one here. Here, as you press these buttons manually, or you plug in a control voltage that says, "Oh, choose that column," then these four control voltages just pop out at these outputs to use whatever you want to use it for. If you want to control pitch or filters or anything like that. Control voltage modifiers are the sort of thing where you could take a voltage that jumps straight up and down like a square wave, and you want to make that slew between things. Well, you have a module that's called a slew generator, a portamento on a keyboard. If you're a standard synthesizer keyboard and you hit a low note and you hit a high note and it goes whoop instead of immediately up there, that's a slew generator. Well, I have a couple in this rig that are, you can control how fast that change happens. You can have a control voltage that tells it how fast that change happens. So you can say you have a sequence which is doing a note thing. You can say, this note, I want it to slide at this speed to the next note, but the next note, I want to slide at this speed. So that sort of things are mechanically that you can do with control voltage modifiers.
And utility modules as well.
Yeah, and there are utility modules which are, yeah, that's actually should be a section up here. Mm-hmm. Things that don't actually fit into those things, like we make these light modules. He loves to promote our gear, so, you know. We make these light modules, and there are a few modules like that, too, that are, don't fall in. They don't actually produce sound. They don't modify sounds. They don't do anything. But a power supply module is another prime example, obviously. It does one thing, and that's all it does, and it's not one of those. Audio generators. Let me punch these up. You have your standard ones, which is a voltage control oscillator, which is a tone generator. It creates a steady pitch at a particular frequency, at a particular shape. The main thing you think about is, like all audio, the shape of the waveform you create makes the sound. How you create that shape and how you change that shape changes the sound. So basically, you are starting at the building blocks of an audio sound. You're walking around and you're listening. You get into synthesizers, and what happens is you start walking around town, and you know, you go by a construction site and you hear this like jackhammer happening, and your brain starts going, well, how can I make that sound? You know, and you start analyzing, well, it has this attack, you know, like, say by snapping my finger here. Well, it has a pitch that's like kind of semi-low, has a fast attack and release, you know, so I could probably make that with a sine wave generator and a, you know, a slow filter change. So there's a snappy snap at the beginning, but then that low end at the end. So, you know, you start analyzing all sounds you hear and figuring out how to make them with a module. So you have a module that does a particular purpose in a sound chain. You know, oh, this filter controls the tonal qualities. This oscillator controls your rudimentary pitch. This envelope generator and VCA combination controls the dynamics. So then by mixing and matching these modules and buying more and more exotic modules, you can do more and more exotic sounds and sound modifications. wave table generators are just another kind of oscillator. The original synthesizers had basic oscillators with four basic shapes, typically a sine wave, a triangle wave, a ramp wave, and a square wave. Then they modified the square wave so you could change its width and its harmonic content that way. Well, nowadays we have something like this Piston Honda, which is a wavetable generator. So it has like a 100 or so wavetables. I can dial up whichever whichever wavetable I'm talking about, whichever group of wavetables, and another division underneath that. And these are digital. It's a digital wave, digital module. So it has wave shapes that are digital ones that are in very exotic shapes. Some are highly harmonically contented, et cetera. Like that's like a Romulator, you know, like a Proteus module or something like that. But it's just the raw waveform part and not everything down the chain. So you can do that that way. Something's leaking through, yeah. Clock generators are timing modules. Basically, they're just oscillators in a lower frequency. So they're used to clock things like this sequencer. This has an internal clock, but I can just as easily run that from an external oscillator that is programmed to do something exotic from another set of modules upstream, you know, that sort of thing. So that's pretty easy. Noise generators create, there's two different types of waveform generators, periodic and non-periodic. Periodic waveforms are ones that repeat all the time within a cycle. So you repeat the same waveform fast enough, it becomes a pitch. Basically, the rule of thumb is something needs to hang around for 13 milliseconds before your brain can understand it as a pitch. Anything less than that, and it's just a click or a pop or a, you know, an atonal noise. But if it's hanging around for that long, then it becomes a pitch. Well, that's a periodic waveform that does that. An aperiodic waveform, like a noise generator, is randomness. You know, and it'll always be randomness. It'll sounds like noise. The different types of noise, like in that the guy was saying, oh yeah, it's got white noise and pink noise and infrared noise. Those are just different filtering topographies built onto the noise. A nice way to demonstrate it in the old days, and when I used to teach back in the 70s, was using a tape recorder. You can take a white noise generator and you record it onto one track, okay, and you get take a pink noise generator and you record it on another track, okay, and then you rewind the tape and you play it at a different speed. The white noise generator will sound the same. The pink noise generator will change pitch. And this is because of the filtering way that the white noise is equal energy per frequency. So any you choose any frequency in the spectrum and the volume level there will be as equal as any other frequency. So it sounds a little more high pitched, a little more because your brain is geared towards hearing high frequency noises. The energy content of, you know, of a low frequency, that way speakers are big for low end, small for high end. Same amount of noise can come out, same amount of energy in those different ranges causes you know, different loudness. You know,
and the top octave has the same amount of energy as everything else.
Yeah,
because
basically.
From 10 to 20K, it's 10,000 hertz, and each one of those
yeah.
underneath.
So in a pink noise is equal energy per octave. So it sounds a little lower because now the low-end stuff has got the same power as the high-end stuff. So that's, but the little, that was a little fun trick that you'd play with a tape recorder. Say, ah, check this out. And, you know, pink noise would go, change pitch. External audio sources is another one. This one here is laid out for controlling external audio stuff. It has a couple of mic preamps in it and mainly filters and VCA. So it's kind of set up to modify external sounds. I find that to be a lot more fun in a lot of cases than actually creating the sounds. Normally you can take sounds that are generated in a kitchen environment, you know, like pans and pots and stuff, and play them through ring modulators and filters and stuff and get some space sounds that people just don't understand. It's from the older edges of the old days, music concrete. That's what it was all about. It was taping things on tape recorders, running them back at different speeds, flipping them around, chopping them up, that sort of stuff. I have some modules here. I have a wave player module here that will take wave files, WAV files from a compact disc card. You plop it in there, a secured SD card, and you plug that in there, and you can control the start time of the wave, the how long that of the loop is being played, and the bit rate of the playback. So you can take audio sounds and just, you know, take them to the point where they're just like, you know, that 8-bit sound that people seem to like. Here are your standard waveforms, and you can see the harmonic contents of them. Basically, the ramp wave is the most harmonically rich of the waveforms. It's most commonly used to cause, to make string sounds, things like that. If you think about how a string being bowed sounds, I mean, the string is being yanked by the bow, and then it snaps back. Well, it's very similar to that shape. So you can see how it could harmonically be similar. A triangle wave is more a flute sounding, more it's all of the odd harmonics. You can see both the square wave and the triangle wave are odd harmonics, but the square wave, each harmonic is a much louder volume over time as you stretch out harmonically. And there's an interesting fact with the square waves. If you have this, if you do the ratio of the uptime versus the downtime on a square wave, okay, if it's 1 to 2, you know, it's up one time for all the two times for the whole waveform, it's half up, whatever. Every even harmonic, every second harmonic is missing. If you change it to something like this, 1 to 9, every ninth harmonic is missing. It's a very nice thing about square waves. So you can get a very, very rich sound by dialing the pulse width of a square wave. And a lot of your basic synthesizers will have pulse width modulation and have it control voltage, so you can have it go and get this harmonic, that harmonics that pop in and pop out very quickly. It's really nice. I'm going to do this whole page. Okay, ways to modify. Standard things are filters. Filters like a coffee filter. A coffee filter is meant to allow water to pass through and keep the grounds behind. Well, that's all filters are like that. They're meant to pass some audio signal and keep some audios out of the way, you know, keep them back. And so you have different shapes of filters and different topographies of filters that cause these different sounds. Voltage-controlled amplifiers, we had a talk earlier about this, is actually a misnomer in that almost all VCAs in these synthesizers do not amplify at all. In the beginning, EMU, I think, had an amplifying VCA that actually gave gain. But almost all VCAs should be called voltage-controlled attenuators, because they're basically turn the sound off until I provide a control voltage that turns it on. It's the first thing that happens when a noob user sits behind one of these machines or any synthesizer that has this topography and goes, why can't the sound just doesn't turn off? It's on all the time. Because the idea of here is the oscillators are playing all the time, all your pitch sources are playing all the time. You run into the VCA, you turn the VCA completely off, and now you turn it on with something else. When you press a key, you turn it on, you know. But so people thinking of amplifiers, they think, oh, this is just volume control. And it's not. It's a dynamic volume control. Ring modulators are, it's a function of, how to put this right. Basically, it's a math function in a module. You start with two inputs signals, an A and a B. And what comes at the output is the mathematical relationship of A plus B and A minus B. Those two pitches get turned into two different pitches, A plus B and A minus B. So say you had a 100 hertz waveform and a 200 hertz waveform. What you'd get at the output is 300 hertz and 100 minus 200. So you'd get a negative waveform, so that wouldn't work. But, but in any case, you get two different waveforms. And every harmonic in those original waveforms goes through the same math. So you get these very complex waveforms. Typically, it's used for making clangorous sounds, bell sounds, metal sounds, metallic sounds, which are very complex sounds. Side note is if those two waveforms are the same waveforms, well, A plus B and A minus B, well, A minus B wipes each other out, so A plus B becomes 2A. So it bends twice the frequency. So you can use a ring modulator to be a crude pitch doubler. The best thing to use with ring modulators are sine waves, for me, because you get a purer sound and not all this chaotic noise in the background. It's nice if you've ever had a shortwave radio or an FM radio and you've been tuning and you go to the space where you suddenly hear these two pitches that start converging and then that's X converging. This is very similar. That's done with amplitude modulation, in which you not only get the A plus B and the A minus B, but you get the original A and B also passed through to heterodyne filtering and that sort of stuff. Phasers and flangers and time-based, almost all those sort of things are do your whooshing sounds caused by phase cancellation. If you time-base, if you take a waveform and you delay it within the width of its own waveform and add it back to the original waveform, it will erase parts of itself. And dynamically, by doing that, you can erase more parts, and so you get the comb filtering effects of a phaser, or the more drastic comb filtering of a flanger. The difference between a phaser and a flanger primarily are that flangers are, the combs are harmonically related. Okay, so that there'll be octaves and, you know, fifths and whatever, you know, whereas a phaser, those are mathematic related. So they'd be like 100 hertz apart from each other or 200 hertz apart from each other and not related by pitch. That's so why you hear in a flanger, it's more tonal. You know, you can actually play the pitches. You can hear it doing that. It's because it's doing a comb filter that's allowing certain frequency ranges to come through in a very pitched way. Audio dividers and wave multipliers. These are, now there's a lot of people making these sort of things. That I have a module here. I don't remember where I put it. You plug in a square wave and you get half the frequency, a fourth of the frequency, an eighth of a frequency, a sixteenth of the frequency. A classic example is an old organ, a tone organ, where it had a real high frequency oscillator and every key is a division of that original frequency, that sort of stuff. And wave multipliers and stuff like that will do things like the symmetry processing modules will take a waveform and fold it back onto itself and subtract it from itself. And you get these weird shaped waveforms from it, which are more harmonically intense because of their odd shapes and also harder to control. And when it comes to natural sounds, a lot of times a natural sound will have a very rich harmonic content because of natural phasing and flanging. Like I'm speaking to you and you're hearing my sound directly, but you're also hearing the sound bouncing off the ceiling, bouncing off the floor, bouncing off the guy next to you. And all that's doing like phase canceling and stuff on its way to you. So, you know, where I stand will make a difference. Where the speakers are will make a difference. You know, that sort of stuff. Well, this is a way of mechanically doing that control yourself, you know, to actually change the sound yourself. That's the power of these synthesizers, that you can mechanically change sound texture. Mixers, panners, and location modulation. That used to be called location modulation back in the day, and that's moving sounds around. This is starting to be more important. Each one of these cases has at least one voltage-controlled panning module in it, where you can run a control voltage and make the sound go back and forth in space, you know, in a stereo system, which is also useful to send to two different filters or to send to a filter in an echo machine or send to, you know, different effects like that. You don't need to necessarily move through space, but a panner has a lot of usages like that. Here's your standard filters, like I was saying before, low pass, high pass, band pass, a notch filter. They allow frequencies below a certain range. The curve is that comes off of the pitch you tune it to, versus everything like in a low pass. Here's where you tune it to, but as you go up from that, the volume level goes lower until it's off, basically. And that, here's an example of just showing it with a low pass filter. The control of that shape is controlled by resonance controls, which will do some, it's a feedback, so it will allow the place you tuned it to get louder than the others. And this will give that yow, wow, sort of like a, you know, wah-wah pedal sort of sound, because you're accentuating that particular small, narrow band of frequencies to make it louder. Now, the big differences between, like, the different filter manufacturers. When people talk about synthesizers, I go on the bulletin boards, and it always cracks me up as people say, well, that oscillator just sounds better than the other oscillator, you know. Well, if they have the same wave shapes, they should sound exactly the same. You know, the only reason that they sound different is because some guy doesn't make his ramp wave has a little dip in the middle of it, or his triangle wave has a little peak sticking out of it or something. You know, there's no difference. Yeah.
Does Monster Cable make your own?
Yeah, exactly. They don't yet. They don't yet, but there is an argument. That's one of the banana. That's one of the banana eighth-inch arguments. Oh, okay. You know, it's like eighth-inch guys. Well, it's unshielded. You know, but we're talking about 10-volt waveforms. You know, you know, shielding really doesn't matter a lot in a 10-volt waveform, unless you're in like a highly in a radio station or something.
Signal-to-noise ratio is through the roof.
Yeah, exactly. It is. Now, the difference in between the different filter makers was this area back here. The Moog filter, when you crank up the resonance, this volume level doesn't change too much, okay? You go to an ARP filter or another company's filter topography, the diode ladder filter topography versus, you know, OTF filter topography or these other filters, this area will start to go down, and it starts becoming more and more like a bandpass filter. And this is what gives the balls in a Moog filter, because the low end doesn't get attenuated as much as when you crank up the resonance. So you can get that peak in the resonance. Back in the day, I did this experiment with two low-pass filters, one that I was changing the resonance on, the other I didn't do anything to, and I stuck them together, and it was killer. Because, you know, you had that low end coming through from the low end. And, you know, made them track together and all that stuff. You had the low end capping through and wasn't attenuated. So that's why you get the Moog filters, whether it was by design or chance, it doesn't matter really. But that's his legacy, was the fact that his low pass filters did not lose the low end when you turn the resonance up. So you got this biting resonance tweak without losing the low end. So all the bass lines that you ever heard with Moogs, that's why they were totally into it, because of that. Okay, we'll go into these here. CV generators. So the big thing about synthesizers that separate them from other musical instruments, you generate the sound electronically. Well, organs all do that, okay? Nothing wrong with that. You modify the sounds electronically. Well, you can have filters on a lot of synthesizers that change the sound, okay? And you control everything electronically. That's where the difference is in a synthesizer. Is everything, almost all the knobs on these synthesizers have also a jack that you can plug an external signal in there, and it'll turn the knob for you, basically. You know, so that's the power. Yeah, sure.
So I was surprised to learn that Moog wasn't the first one to do that. Control voltage. I thought that was his big deal.
Well, I was kind of surprised too. The Lecrae guy was the first guy to actually use a control voltage control. Now, the stuff he was doing was not as advanced as what Moog was doing. As Moog was centered on making a tonal instrument and stuff like that. But yes, that's also a manually controlled control versus a control voltage control. I mean, the Lecrae Sackboot, he had manual knobs and pressure, things that he moved with his fingers. Those were still controlling other circuits with a control voltage. Okay. But he wasn't like using a low frequency oscillator or something like that to do it. In these systems, you can completely make algorithmic sounds where you push a button and walk off, and it's playing by itself, you know, and it'll do, you know, very exotic stuff, because you can just have events trigger other events that trigger multiple events that trigger other sets of events that feedback and do other things like that. So these are the ways that you do it with CV generators, which are almost more important than your sounds and your filter stuff. Because, you know, you can have a few filters and stuff, but how you control those things is the important way to make the sound under your command. A classic one is a keyboard. You know, the keyboard synthesizer has a keyboard that does a volt per octave. As you press the key, it produces a gate signal, which then tells envelope generators to turn on to this particular shape that you have programmed in for the shape of the sound that you want. Those would be underneath aperiodic envelope generators and followers, random voltage generators. I have a bunch of these. This is a quad envelope generator here. This is a pingable envelope generator, and that I can tap this button up here.
And I'll
patch these things up later, and you can hear them. But basically, these control the shapes of the sounds that you want to make, and those are ones. So that's how you get the very basic synthesizer voice, is an oscillator for pitch, a filter to change the timbre, a voltage controlled amplifier to change the volume, and an envelope generator that tells the filter to open up and the volume to open up in a particular shape that you program in. That's a classic voice. Now, how you tell that envelope generator to turn on and how you tell that oscillator what pitch to play, that's when you get into these things, where you can have a sequencer like this that tells the pitches of what's going on. It can also have a control voltage that controls the filter at the same time, so each note can have a different filter setting. Or you could tell a low-frequency oscillator to do a pitch bend at a particular frequency for each note. So each note in that phrase can have a completely different sound. The programmers that we make these programmers, and that's what they're about, is I can set up these parameters for parts of a sound, and by pushing a button, I can go change the sound radically. It's like a programming, we'll talk about that in a later, but that programming is the biggest problem on these machines, is remembering what you did last. Manual controls, like these joysticks. Joysticks basically control, put a voltage that as I move the stick to the top, the voltage gets higher. If I move it to the left, the voltage gets higher. So I can control two parameters at one time with something like a joystick. I can also use these ones here. These are, ooh, that's me. These are pressure pads. SynthWorks, we make those pressure-sensitive modules. As you press on the pad, the harder you press, the larger the control voltage comes out. So you can use that to do expressive sort of stuff by pressing harder on them. Slide pot modules, same thing. It's, you know, voltage as you go higher. So these are all manual controls. Exotic controls are like the pressure-sensitive. MIDI to CV converters, I have one of those in here somewhere. I'm trying to remember where everything is. Oh, yeah, down here. Which will take a MIDI note numbers, MIDI note commands, and can produce a control voltage that follows the volt per octave rule and a gate. So you can take your standard MIDI controller and run these things with it, or your standard MIDI sequencer. There are other ones that, basically, this is the thing about control voltage. You can make control voltages out of almost anything. You can use a pot, a knob that you just wire up to a battery. You can use a photocell and wave your hands over it. I've made ribbon controllers in the past out of old tape recorder tape, and plugging a juicer into one end and having it hung over a piece of copper. And as you press and get closer to that end, I mean, the tape recorder tape is just a big resistor, and basically. So you can do that. You can make anything. That's what's so cool about it. If you have a brainwave thing that's meant to run some little trick and it actually produces a control voltage thing, well, why not? Yeah, why not use it? That's the way you can make mechanical stuff. Modifiers, yeah. Modifiers are, we'll take a control voltage and make it into another control voltage or change it in some way. I talked about slew rate converters before. Polarity inverters, say you want to have you're playing a keyboard line and you want to have one oscillator go up in the pitch at the same time as another one goes down in a pitch. Well, you can plug those into the same one control voltage into an inverter, plug it into one, and you have the straight voltage into another. And now as you go up, as the voltage goes up in one place, it goes down in another. It's very simple. Or say you have a typical one would be an LFO that, say you have a ramp wave LFO that's up and then down, and you want it instead to go down and then up. Well, they use an inverter. Inverters also work for audio, but there's no sound change. I mean, an inverse waveform sounds the same thing as a regular waveform, except if you have, there's debate on, audiophiles will say, well, if I have a kick drum and that first part of the waveform is pushing the cone out, then it's going to sound different than if that first part of the waveform sucks the cone back. But we're talking like one waveform before it changes. So you're not going to hear that difference, but audiophiles are audiophiles. VC polarizers and polarizing mixers are just combining a mixer function, which mixes different signals together, with an inverter. And a lot of them will have something where the knob, if I plug a control voltage in here and I have a knob, if I turn the knob this way, it'll go up in value. If I turn it this way, it'll start inverting itself. So you can mix control voltages together to get these very complicated waveforms and stuff in that way. Logic modules are just like they sound, AND gates, OR gates, plug two gates into them. If you're into dance music and you want to make dance music with a synthesizer, buy a bunch of logic modules because you're going to be loving that sort of stuff. Mixing, you know, mixing different LFO rates together to get rhythmic patterns and get atonal rhythmic patterns or asymmetrical rhythmic patterns. That's all done with logic stuff. Quantizers and level detectors. I have a quantizer in here, right there. That what it does is it'll take that smooth ramp thing and break it into the steps of the octave. So when you're dealing with something like a sequencer that has typically has a knob that's rim and you're trying to tune it, you know, it's like crazy. Well, you can run into a quantizer and now it goes, goes to the notes in the octave. And you can flip a switch on it and say, oh, I want it to be, you know, fifths, I want it to be thirds. IntelliGel makes one that has a little bit of keyboard and push buttons, and you can press, okay, I want to choose these notes out of the scale and only these notes. And then if you plug in like a sine wave, it'll only play the notes that you chose. It won't do all the in-betweens. So it'll just go do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, which is very cool for a lot of effects. And combo modules are, I have a few here. A vocoder system is, vocording, like we talked about earlier, basically is a set of filters and a set of VCAs and a set of control voltages. So basically you have, at the beginning you have your program, which would be like what you want to affect, okay? And then you have your carrier, which is the thing that you want to use to control stuff. The classic thing is the talking robot voice thing that you for vocoder effects. Well, that's a very crude vocoder. Basically, it takes the sound of whatever it's in the input, splits it up into the frequency domain, like in a parametric equalizer. You know, you have a slider for each one. It produces a control voltage for each one of those octaves or third of an octave or whatever. Then at the other end of the spectrum, you have a bank of filters with voltage control amplifiers after them that are run by the same control voltages that you pulled out of here. So what you do is like you, as you speak into here, it creates a set of control voltages that follow your speech. And at this end, those control voltages now control filters and amplifiers. And so when you plug in your organ or your synth, now only the frequencies that match what you were speaking at this end come through. The fun part is that you can rearrange these, you know, so you can have like the low end or control the high end over here. You get into some of the newer digital ones, which have 16 band ones, like the Nord has a really great one on its synthesizer. And you can do stuff like talk, and like say you talk into one end of the control part, and you use crowd noises or, you know, industrial noises in the other, and you can have it actually sound like this crowd is speaking, you know, when it's, you know, it's just very crude. And the finer the filters and the more the filters, the better the effect is. And most of the ones that you used to buy, the Korg and those little ones that were mainly for talking voice sort of stuff, they were very crude. They had like maybe a dozen filters at most, if you're lucky, you know. It's almost like those talking box things. Well, the talking box things, what that is doing is it's firing a speaker. You can make one of those talking box things fairly easy. You get a speaker driver and you screw it into one of those hose things that used to plug into the into a faucet to turn into a shower, you know. You chop the shower head off and you stick that hose in your mouth instead, and you play your music through the hose into your mouth, and if you shape your mouth, which is acting like a filter, into the shapes that you want to speak, well, it's going to impart your voice onto the sound. Into a microphone. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a... oops. Let's go back here. Multiples of standard modules are another one. Like, I have a few here that are called... Like, this is called a voltage control... Oh, sorry, not that one. This one here. A voltage-controlled voice module or signal processor. It has a filter, a VCA, a panner, all in one module. So, you know, you can buy modules like that, do multiple things at one time. And it's got patch points all along it, so you can use the different sections individually or together. There's also voice modules you can buy that have oscillators, filters. A standard voice in a one panel that takes up a lot less room. If you're playing melodic music a lot, that's the way to go, because if you try to start racking up a voice, like basically these three cabinets here are dedicated to one voice. There's two oscillators, a filter, a VCA filter combination, and some control things. So, you know, that's a lot of hardware to make one mono voice, you know, so one of the big limitations. Okay, layout and patching. And we talked about the religious wars. There's other types of patching. The original EMS that I showed a long time ago, the big, huge one, had what's called pin matrix patching, which was like all the outputs of the modules. Think of a board with a lot of holes in it, okay? All the outputs of all the modules go across this way, and all the inputs to the modules go up this way. So if you plug a pin at that cross point, now you're plugging this output to this input. So if you plug three pins along the way, well, now you're playing into four different things or three different things. Or if you plug, you know, you could stack and mix and match as many ways as you want. Switch matrix was like the ARP, the big ARP synthesizers had these slide switches. So basically all the outputs came with these slide switches, and you slid up to bus number one. Now anything else you slid up to bus number one was connected. So it was the fast and easiest way of not having to deal with the spaghetti here. Dedicated and semi-patch systems are like the ARP 2600 and the synthesizers like that, which are normalized. There's the phrase normalized. A lot of these jacks, like the jacks in this voice module I was talking about, this jack is plugged into the input of this jack, is plugged into the input of that jack, into that jack. And as long as I don't stick a plug in there, those will connect. The minute I stick a plug in there, it breaks the connection and now it comes out the plug. That's called normalizing. It's normally connected that way. An ARP 2600 was all normalized. It's like you could just pull up sliders and boom, you had a sound. But if you wanted to, you could plug in at different places and break that sound and use the module for different places. So there's a convenience factor involved there, which is really nice about semi-modular systems. Patch memory. Here's the big one. The differences between, whoops, back there. The classic for this one, if you want to remember this patch, whip out your old cell phone and take pictures, because that's the only way. Or don't tear it down, you know, because it's not going to remember anything. If you can get by with it by something like a programmer, which if you stack and get enough programmers, then you can tell, like for a live situation, for instance, you can program in changes of parameters in a way that you can manually say, okay, the song has this setting and I can do that. And it's the same thing as turning a bunch of dials to the same spots that you wanted them to be at. But it won't change chords. We plan on making one in the future that does patch chords at the same time too. So you can use those to do a rudimentary patching. But it's better than this, which is basically in this setup, like I came with some of these already pre-patched because I just put the lids on and didn't take the cords off. If you're going to do a gig with this sort of stuff, that's why in the movie I was impressed that the guy from Radiohead had a modular on stage and played live in the modular, is because there's no programming in those. You know, he either kept that patch the same for his whole tour, you know, and then didn't turn knobs, or he turned them with controllers, or he remembered, he took photographs and went there. I saw an interview once with Robert Langner, I think is his name. He plays a bukla. And you look at his setup, and it's just like masses of cables. And the way he said it was, I've done so many shows that I don't have to remember. You know, it's like second nature to go to patch this up. I've patched this up so many times. And that's the other way, too. Practice, practice, practice. If you do the same sounds, or the other side of that is, who cares? You know, I mean, it's right. You know, I mean, if you're not, I'd say a vast majority and more of modular players are not playing tonal music because it's just not worth it. Yeah.
Sounds like a good place to have tons of different colors of cables and stripes.
Yes. Well, yeah, you could see I have multiple colored cables, and that's the way to do it. And people either have colored cables, or there's this company that I buy my cables from. And they have, They have these little colored O-rings that you can slide over the edge of your cable to color code them to be what you want.
They're striped colors.
Yeah, well, there's people who have put heat shrink, is the other one. You put heat shrink on them, and colored heat shrink and shrink them up. That's a good way to remember that sort of stuff. But basically, the noise crowd, or bug music is another phrase that they use. People play abstract stuff that's really... They start from nothing every night because that's part of the fun. You know, that's part of the joy or the danger or the excitement of playing, is to make that patch while you're on live and you're doing it live. I have tons of respect for these guys, because sometimes they'll wander into a space and it's like, you know, I've played the synthesizer at times at home and it's like, wow, that's bitching. And then it's like, bring out the camera, you know, or really see what I'm doing. Because sometimes you can get so many interlinking patch parts that you can't recreate it. There's just no way. I used to own a Synthi AKS and a VCS3s, which were one of these original old, the Putney synthesizers. And they had problems with tuning and with interaction of modules at a level that you just forgot about it. You know, forget about trying to get the same patch. You know, you recorded everything. You basically, you know, if something's going on, I record it and then I'll drop it into Ableton, you know. We'll play it in Ableton, you know, because otherwise I'm, you know, this is gone forever. And that's really a good way of doing it. Dedicated digital programmers. The Buchla has a digital programmer in it. The old Oberheim Four Voice had a digital programmer. Basically, it's just like one of these programmers here. It's a bunch of parameters that are remembered. The Buchla one also connects in the back through a bus through a lot of its modules, so it will remember knob positions. It will remember patching at a really rudimentary level. It has a patch matrix, like an 8-in and 8-out matrix, that if you plug things into there, it'll go, oh, this cord was connected to this cord, and this cord was connected to this cord. But as far as it knowing what those cords went and did, it doesn't care. You know, it just does that, you know, that way. And that's basically the only way you can go. There is the AKS I was talking about, they used to have this thing called a Presto patch on the end. It was that matrix of ins and outs. Well, each one of those lines came out to this little PC edge connector. And you could take this edge connector and make your little, solder up a PC board that had all the jacks and the points that you had plugged into it. So you slam this into the slot, and it was just like punching in a bunch of these pegs. And you can make that sort of a patch matrix for these guys, you know, a lot of jacks and a lot of, and it's not that expensive, but it's like, why? You know, it's like you have to remember that what you plugged into that column and into this row to do it, make it work. And it's like, you know, you might as well just patch direct at that point if you're remembering that much. So anyway, and this is our organization. If you want to join and talk to people, there's a lot of boards on the net that are really very useful for anyone who's interested in synthesizer stuff, who wants to ask questions, and a lot of them are very tolerant of noobs because they all used to be them, and so they aren't too bad. Electromusic.com has got a fairly large thing, but probably the best one around is one called the unfortunate name of Muff Wigglers. But Muff Wigglers, Synthesizers, and Cats. Anyway, it is probably the best board there is. And there are sub-boards in it that cover the different formats. There are sub-boards that are done by manufacturers that talk about their gear. There's software stuff on there. It's a huge crowd. It's free board, and it's well worth going to. And mostlymodular.com is we're just starting out, basically. It was originally done for our local manufacturers. There's a large number of local Euro manufacturers in Seattle and Portland area. You know, Division 6, Flight of Harmony, The Harvest Man. Those are all local. Matson Modular, that's local. Now in Portland, there's a bunch of them moved in Portland, Forum S, Maleco Heavy Industries. There's a lot. And so, you know.
And most of them will be here Saturday.
Yeah, Saturday will be the big thing. The thing about Saturday that's really good is going to be the petting zoo, in that you can come in and see people's rigs that they've built up. I mean, you can look at this rig and you're going to, okay, question you might have is, how much does that cost? Well, if I was to buy these new, it'd be about $2,000 per case. Maybe, you know, up and down. It depends, you know. But this is also the end of 5 or 6 years of me buying modules, you know, starting off with one case and filling it up. That's the thing about modular synthesizers, is that you buy a case and you buy a module and then you buy another module and the next paycheck comes in and the next one. And then you go, you hear about this other groovy one and you say, okay, I don't need this one anymore. Sell it and buy another one. And, you know, it just keeps growing and growing. And then you see those guys in that video who have the walls of them. You know, I mean, it's like, yeah, okay, then you need these, you know, 10-foot long patch cords to actually go between things, you know. And that's more than I need. I mean, if you don't really need a huge modular. I myself personally like to do things live. You know, I like to play live and make sounds live. If you are a recordist, you just need a basic system, because you're going to record everything you do. You're going to record those in multiple passes and build up things that way. You got to remember, Wendy Carlos's Switched on Bach, that was done one note at a time, one phrase at a time. If there's a chord in there, she recorded it, you know, multiple times to get that, you know, because that was a monophonic instrument, you know. So if you have the time and the patience and the tools, you don't need a lot of synthesizer, you know, you just, you know, but I tell you, you're going to want to buy a lot of synthesizers. The minute you start getting into this stuff, it's like they were saying, it's like crack, you know, you just.
So let's take a break and have cookies and water, not milk. And make sure you sign up for the door prizes here. And then after a few minutes, let's get into actually patching, making